And now, Move the Sticks with Daniel Jeremiah and Bucky Brooks.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to Move the Sticks. DJ Bucky back with you. Buck, how you doing, man?
Man, I'm good, DJ. This is a really fun time of year. Obviously, we're kicked off and running with the NFL, but the college stuff is also fascinating because now, you know how we do. Once you begin to see three or four games on college guys, you begin to kind of do reports and kind of make some opinions on some of these guys. And so we're hitting that point. So a lot of work, but a lot of fun.
Yeah, no doubt. Get a chance to head out to Kansas City this week for Chargers Chiefs. Looking forward to that. The plane ride's kind of where I get my, you know, some college tape done. So I'm looking forward to picking out who I want to watch. I guess Northern Iowa's got a tackle, supposed to be pretty good. A lot of people really like talking to guys around the league. So I might check him out. Today, we got a busy show, though. We've got one of our favorite guests coming off one of the biggest wins in college football, and that's Mario Cristobal, head coach at Oregon. He's going to join us a little bit later on. Love catching up with him about how he's built that program and has a true identity up there for that Oregon football program. So we'll have that conversation coming up in just a little bit. Want to hit on some stats that maybe are a little unordinary stats that piqued my interest, and I want to get your thoughts on those, Buck, as well as a conversation about points versus yards. Which I think is a good one to have. So we've got a lot of ground to cover. Before we get there, though, I didn't know if you noticed my lid. Can you tell me who what this hat is?
That would be the Seattle Kraken.
Yes.
You are all in. Yeah. I appreciate you paying attention to the NHL. I know there's a lot of excitement about what is going on in the Pacific Northwest with the hockey team coming over. And look, DJ, I think one of the things or one of the lanes that we've kind of fallen into is we love football, but we love the process of building successful teams. And I think that transcends every sport. And so as you begin to kind of dig into your fandom with the Kraken, and I'm sure you will follow how they build the team. After the Stanley Cup, I talked about the Tampa Bay Lightning and how they have built a team that is a powerhouse. And so I just think there's so many lessons to be learned and just watching that stuff. So I certainly would have my eye on the Kraken after spending a couple of years in Seattle with the Seahawks.
Yeah, well, this is what I'm going to get to because this is a hat. It's from my good friend Rick Olchek, who's the assistant GM up there, and they did a great job just trying to get this thing off the floor here with an expansion franchise. So I have not been a hockey follower. But since I became friends with Rick, I was like, okay, you guys are going to be I'm adopting the Seattle Kraken as my hockey team. So the question is, Buck, do you have a hockey team yet?
You know, DJ, I don't. But what I would do
okay,
is –
Hold on.
Would you like to make
the Seattle Kraken?
Ooh.
I got you a hat. I've got you a hat. They can be the official Move the Sticks hockey. Yeah, hockey sticks. Hockey sticks.
Oh, my gosh. That might be enough to get me. How about
that? Can I get you?
Yeah, that might be enough to get me.
Now, I'll bring this on Monday. I'll bring this to you on Monday.
I will say this. We had a landscaping company for a long time. We have since put it to bed, but we had a landscaping company for 10 years. My dad would actually some of his clientele were the Hurricanes. And it's when the Carolina Hurricanes were good and maybe they went one Stanley Cup and those things. So I would kind of follow them. But when I was playing, my first hockey game was up in Buffalo with the Sabres. And at the time, Dominic Hasek was the goalie. And so it was very much, if the Sabres scored, it was over. 1-0, it was over because the Dominator was so good at that time that you couldn't score on them. And so I love going to hockey games. I think it's a great sport. I think it's particularly exciting to watch in the playoffs. I'm more of a playoff guy. I love the pressure of it. And then when they go to the extra periods and they remove some of the people off the ice and it becomes a more wide open game, I dig it.
All right. So you're joining me here. The Kraken. That's the NHL team of choice for the podcast here. All right, let's jump into this, Buck. I want to get into some stats that I thought were interesting. I've recently been able to really jump in on next gen stats. And I think people hear next gen stats and they think of, you know, basically MPH, like who were the fastest guys this weekend, you know, whatever. There is an infinite number of stats that you can jump in on here. And so I've finally got my hands on the entire database so I can look at everything. And I'm trying to find out, okay, you know, what are some stats that interest me, but then also have, you know, value in talking to folks around the league. And one of the ones that I've come across is get off time. And so I've seen this referenced every now and then, like, oh, this guy has, you know, the fifth highest get off time. So my first question was, how is it tabulated? How are you coming up with that? And basically, it's from when the ball leaves the ground to when both of your shoulders cross the line of scrimmage. So the original line of scrimmage. So if you think about that, there's times where you can anticipate the snap count, right? So you get it right. And there's other guys that have big time bursts. What you come to look at when you look at these numbers and study the tape is it's a little bit of a combination of the two. You've got big time juice and burst, but you've also got a little bit of a feel with anticipating and getting off the rock. So I wanted to go through and say, okay, well, let's see. We always talk to D-line coaches and they say get off's the most important thing. Well, now we have data that can tell you who are the guys that get off better than anybody else. So what does it look like? Well, how about this? So this year, through just a couple games, you know who's number one in get-off is Joey Bosa. I think we both agree he's an elite player.
Yeah.
Let me tell you. But the interesting thing is, so you look at some of these names. So number three on the list is Yannick Ngakoue, who is a good addition for the Raiders, who has had a history of sack production. Number four on the list is Myles Garrett. Enough said.
Yeah.
Big time. These are big-time dudes. So when I see stuff like that, then I go, okay, well, let me, and I'll get to who's number two on this list in a second. So then I go, okay, let me go back to last year and let's see who the guys were that went through a whole slate of games and who were the top in the league at get off. So last year, number one get off in the league last year was TJ Watt. And we just saw the money he just got paid. Number two was Bud Dupree, same team, Steelers. He just got a huge contract off what he did. Number three on the list, Carl Lawson. Look at the money Carl Lawson got with the Jets. Obviously, he unfortunately got hurt. Next on the list, Yannick Ngakoue. Repeat for this year. After him, Myles Garrett. Repeat from this year. So there's no scrubs in that bunch. There's no imposters. Those are all real dudes. So that tells me that this get-off number means something. And so that's why I'm curious when I see some new names through just a couple games pop on this list. Number two in get-off right now through 2 weeks, AJ Epenesa. With the Buffalo Bills. So like that tells me you want to buy stock in somebody, buy stock in that dude, because he's living. We talk about what neighborhood do you live in? He's living in the right neighborhood.
He is living in the right neighborhood. So DJ, it's funny that you bring this up. So this is pre next gen stats, but this is how I'll tell you it's impacted me in terms of pass rushers. I would say that I've been blessed and fortunate to play with, I would say, three of the all time great pass rushers in football. I play with Reggie White, Bruce Smith, and Derek Thomas.
I guess so.
And so how I was influenced by watching those guys go about their business, get off is everything. So for Derek Thomas and Bruce Smith in particular, Derek Thomas had the fastest get off that I've ever seen. And so in watching him and then watching Von Miller when he was coming out, I was a big Von Miller fan because it's about snap count anticipation and athleticism and explosiveness. It's, can you see the center squeeze the ball and anticipate the count and go? And the guys who are able to master what I call jumping the count, they're the ones who have those games where they see five, six, seven sacks because you're just like, holy smokes. Derek Thomas had seven sacks in a game on Monday night when I was playing for the Chiefs versus the Raiders. And it's unlike anything that I've ever seen, right? Mm. And so when you talk about get-off times and how certain things translate. So when we go to the combine, and everyone always talks about the 40 and those things.
Yep.
But in pass rushers, now when you talk about these stats, now I'm so honed in on the 10. What is the 10 like? What is that burst, that initial burst coming out like? So then when you take that, you take the next gen stats, and then when you talk to D-line coaches, because we've heard D-line coaches tell us, what's the number one thing you look for in a pass rusher? First thing is always get off.
Get off every time.
How do they get off the ball? And so it's one of those things that we know when we're doing scouting things, we're talking about tried and trues, things that stand the test of time. It appears that get off lasts the test of time. So that's why we should be able to bank on these kind of analytics and stats to help us find who the next best pass rushers are going to be.
Yeah. No, I want to do some more homework on AJ Epenesa too, because I think he lost, what'd he lose, 15 pounds, 20 pounds or something like that? From when he was in college?
Okay, so that may make a difference. But look, remember when he was coming out of Iowa, DJ, he was one of the more technically sound
players. He was a big, heavy, like you thought he was a big, heavy base end who could rush. And now we're talking about his get-off is up in the top five in the whole league.
So what that means is someone gave him feedback or he gathered enough intel to know that if I'm going to get on the field and be an elite pass rusher, I got to be able to get off the ball. And I got to get off the ball faster. And I got to spend my entire offseason to becoming one of those guys who has cat-like quickness off the ball. And DJ, I don't think it is all athleticism. I think it's a combination of instincts and explosive power coming off the ball.
Yeah. No, I think it is. I think it all kind of goes together. And I think you also see something interesting with TJ Watt being up there and with Bud Dupree on the same team. It kind of begs a couple questions here. Number one is those guys are a lot of two-point stance rushes, you know, so that's interesting. And then the other thing, it's like, what are they teaching them with what they're able to see with anticipation in Pittsburgh, those guys being teammates, to be up there as high as they were off of last year. You know, TJ Watt was number one, Bud Dupree was number two. Last I checked, that's pretty good. But then there's games like, you know, who else is up there from last year? Jamal Adams is right behind Myles Garrett. So he's obviously not a pass rusher, but he's a safety who's got tremendous. He's going to be the best of all time when he's done.
He is a pass rusher.
Yeah.
What he is he's a second level pass rusher. He is a pass rusher. The best part of his game is when he comes off the edge, which is why I didn't feel bad about the Seahawks paying him. Because in a way, you're paying him to be a pass rusher.
To get the quarterback,
Which is why. And so now you use him accordingly. But that's interesting about two things that you talk about. The two-point stance potentially being something. Because being a track athlete, I would say three-point stance will allow you to fire off faster. But it might be something where maybe you see the ball better when you're upright and looking in as opposed to with your hand down. So that's something that we'll talk about. And then Pittsburgh. I want to look up – I think Pittsburgh's – D-line coach is Carl Dunbar, who spent a lot of time with Rex Ryan and those guys.
He's with the Jets at the time.
Yeah, with the Jets and also with the Buffalo Bills. Yeah, Carl Dunbar. And so, DJ, I also think, like, when we talk about it, I think you have to pay a premium for the positions that we say are vital when it comes to coaching. Not only paying for pass rushers and offensive linemen, but if I'm a head coach in the National Football League, the first couple of areas that I'm taking care of, the O and D line.
Oh, absolutely.
And I'm willing to.
There's a big difference between the good coaches and the bad coaches. That makes a big difference.
And I'm willing to pay a premium to make sure that I have the best D line coach and the best O line coach that I can have. I don't think it's a coincidence that the Cleveland Browns on offense are getting after people with Bill Callahan being the O line coach. Mm-hmm. And so I would say the same. Like when you look at what the Steelers and how you name Bud Dupree. And TJ Watt. And remember, Bud Dupree took a while for his game to pop. You know, Carl Dunbar has only been there, I think, 2 years. So I am investing in those guys because I think there's a secret sauce to being able to be a great D-line coach. And at the collegiate level at Ohio State, everyone talks about Larry Johnson Sr. and the work that he's done with all those guys. And so I'm willing to fork over cash for guys that are going to have an immediate impact on the game.
Yeah, the interesting thing is I'm looking through here on this top list, and I have not studied a lot of the Tennessee Titans, but Bud Dupree's not anywhere real high on that list this year. So interesting. But so here's two other points I want to get to on a get off. We've talked about maybe the most improved defense in the NFL through 2 weeks, the Raiders. Mm-hmm. You've got Ngakoue, who for the second year in a row, obviously wasn't with the Raiders last year. Second in a row, he's in the top five. So he's proven what he does getting off the rock. So Ngakoue's up there. He is number three. Max Crosby's number seven. So you've got two rockets coming off the edges there for the Raiders. And then the other team we would talk about, who we've already talked about on the show, is a team with a smothering defense, the Carolina Panthers. You've got Brian Burns, who's eighth, and then Hassan Reddick is inside the top 15 as well. So, and they've got Marquise Haynes is probably in the top 25. He's not too far down below. So you've got – it doesn't deceive you. When you watch the tape and you say that is a fast defense, and the best defenses go throughout history are the fast ones, and you watch the tape and you're, man, this team just looks different. They look fast. Now we have numbers and data that – is it data or data? I still don't know the proper
way to say that. I always call it data.
Yeah, it's there. It shows you that we're not – your eyes are not lying to you.
Okay, so a few more points coming out of that. One, so we talked about now we know that get-off times and all that stuff is tried and true, not only in combine and workouts leading up to the draft, but now that we can measure it in game action, we know that get-off times are real and significant. The other thing that I bring up, the Raiders. Mm-hmm. Gus Bradley reuniting with Rod Marinelli. everyone can talk about Rob Marinelli and the things that he does. We know he gets guys to play hard, to play with maximum effort and energy. You now take Gus Bradley, who has been around some great pass rushers, just comes from the Chargers where he had Melvin Ingram and Joey Bosa. So now you have a defensive coordinator who understands and appreciates the pass rush, teaming up with a D-line coach who's one of the best. Lo and behold, the Raiders all of a sudden look like a different defense because they can get off the ball. And then in knowing Matt Rhule and having multiple conversations with Matt Rhule on the podcast when he talked about speed and valuing speed at a premium, particularly on defense, it's not a coincidence that the Panthers' defense is fast. He went and got a guy, and well, Burns was already there. They didn't draft him. Burns was already there. But Hassan Reddick, who at Temple made the unique transition from going in the back to now being in the front, to having his hand down. So you got basically a former safety that is now a pass rusher. So you have a faster team, and that impacts the pass rush, particularly if you can find a way to stop the run on early downs.
All right, I want to get to we've been talking about these two teams. So this is kind of there's some logic involved here, Buck. So we've said get off is the most important thing. We've given you the Raiders and the Panthers as the two teams that have both their edge rushers in the top 15 of get off. So get off's important. We're saying these two teams are better defensively. They're getting off the ball. So now we go from get off percentage to pressure percentage. So now we can tie in directly. Mm-hmm. Does that impact how much pressure you're getting on the quarterback? Not just getting off the snap, but are you getting pressure? Number one team in the league in pressure percentage, the Carolina Panthers. The number two team in the league in pressure percentage, the Las Vegas Raiders. So there you go. There is the line connecting the two. Get off and pressure. They're mm-hmm. literally, you can't, how do you refute that? I know it's only two games through here, but it's just, it's plain as plain as day here.
No, I mean, it is about in a league that is a passing league. It is about defending the pass. It's about getting to the quarterback. It's about finding a way to impact the quarterback at every level, offense and defense. Protect him, get him playmakers, and make sure that you're calling the game in his favor. And then on defense, it's about putting pressure on the quarterback, disrupting his timing in the pocket, and making sure you can shrink the windows on the outside. So now you're telling me get off and pressure percentage, they're hand in hand. If I am a team builder and I'm looking at these things and I'm thinking about the best way to build my team in this new era, DJ, I am investing heavily in athletic pass rushers every year because you need to have more than just one or two guys on your D-line that can get after it. You would like to be able to have a stable of guys that you can just roll in the game and get after the quarterback. And those guys not only need to be guys that can put their hand down, but they need to be some second level blitzer hybrid types that also can impact the pass rush coming from depth.
Yeah, and the Panthers, when you study their tape, they're getting some free run throughs because of some of their creative rush that they've been able to put out there. They've blitzed 29% of the time. So they've blitzed 20 times in two games, which is kind of in the middle of the pack, maybe a little bit towards the higher, actually more towards the higher percentage. Although you got a 40% there with Miami. I think they might be tops in the league. So they're all the way up there at 40%. Kansas City's at 36%. But this is the interesting thing. The Raiders have blitzed six times in two games, 8%. That's the lowest blitz rate in the NFL. So you're getting the second most pressure percentage, second highest pressure percentage in the league with the lowest blitz percentage. That, my friend, is sustainable.
Absolutely sustainable. And it's everything that every defensive coordinator should want because what Gus Bradley is able to do, he's getting maximum pressure with minimal coverage risk. So now I can send three or four, put seven in coverage or eight, and now I can defend everything that you want to do. Ideally, you like to sit in that because that's the best way to play coverage because you got more bodies than they can put out and flood and rouse. And so Gus Bradley's having his way. Like, he's blitzing because he wants to, not because he has to, and that's the difference.
Yep, and Gus Bradley in his position room with the Chargers when he was there, he said when I was talking to him on the bus one time, I wrote it down. He said he focuses on six things before every game and after every game. Number one, stop the run. Two, limit explosive plays. Three, third down efficiency. Four, red zone. 5 sacks and 6 all about the ball, you know, generating turnovers. Mm-hmm. Interesting that stop the run is up there because, you know, a lot of people, there's different philosophies on that, which I think can get us into our next conversation, which is points versus yards. Because I think you're seeing old school is yards. New school mm-hmm. is points. You know what I mean by that?
Yeah. So when we think about the way that you measure an elite defense, the old school metric used to be about yards allowed. How many yards per game are you giving up? Rushing yards, passing yards, and those things. New school is, it's about points. I would say that in talking to defensive coordinators over time, most of them would say, look, man, it's always about points. And there's a certain number that they would tell you, if you're playing great defense, you're holding them below that number. And that number typically is 17. That's kind of the number that you shoot for from a defensive standpoint. If you can hold people to 17 points, DJ, in the National Football League, you should win the overwhelming majority of your games.
Absolutely.
That is a great defensive effort if you're only surrendering 17 points. I think when the Seattle Seahawks and the Baltimore Ravens and those teams are playing at their best in their heyday, you're talking about right around 15 or 14, which is uncommon. 17 points per game, if you're in that range, you typically should always be in the top 5 or top 10, top 5 for sure, because that's just the way that it goes. And there are different ways to achieve that part of it. So, you know, like David Shaw, we talked about David Shaw being a friend of the program. I played for his dad, Willie Shaw, who was a longtime D coordinator in the league. I played for him in Oakland. And I continue to talk to him. And he says that defensive coordinators need to be able to assess the kind of team that they have, and they have to begin to call the game accordingly. Meaning, if I'm a team that doesn't necessarily have great pass rushers and those things, then what we want to do is we want to be a great team in the red zone. So yep. What we'll do is we'll play soft traditional coverages. We won't let the ball fly over our heads. We'll keep everything in front. But when the ball reaches the 30-yard line, we will spend all of our practice time devoted to being great in the red zone and forcing people to kick field goals as opposed to touchdowns. And so he says, if I have a team that can create plays and I got pass rushers, now I can be more aggressive out in the field. But if I don't have those things, then what I want to do is I want to spend the bulk of my practice time working on the red zone. I want to have a few different tricks in the red zone to force people to kick as opposed to score. And you have to understand it. And I think that's what great coaches do.
Yeah, it is really interesting. Last week, for perspective, the Rams had the number one defense in the league. Points allowed 18.5. So as the league has trended more towards offense, you know, 17 used to be that marker. I would say, look, there were only 3 teams in the league last year that allowed under 20 points a game. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I would say, you know, probably 21. You probably could even go. And if you're at 21, you're a top five, top six in the league in terms of points allowed. So this year, what's interesting, and again, I kind of come back to kind of, you know, watching this Chargers team. Last year, the Rams were number one in yards allowed and points. So with that was a dominant unit. But like this year, the Chargers, in terms of rushing yards, they've allowed the third most. Like, look at these teams. This is the rushing yards allowed, okay? Kansas City, number one. They're giving up 202 rushing yards a game. Yikes. Seattle is second worst, 162.5 a game. Chargers, 162 a game. Green Bay, 139 a game. So when I look at those teams, KC, Seattle, the Chargers, the Packers, those are 4 dynamic offenses. So if you think about the team building process, if we believe we are going to score a bunch of points, you don't build a run-stopping defense. You don't care because teams aren't going to be able to run the ball because you're going to run up the score and they're going to have to keep pace. I think that's kind of fascinating when you look at kind of the connection there between great offenses and bad run defenses.
Yeah, and I think that has always been the case for a long time. Going back to my experience in the National Football League as a player, the Buffalo Bills had come off 4 straight Super Bowl appearances when I joined the team. The offense was dominant. The Hall of Famers on that offense, Jim Kelly, Thurman Thomas, Andre Reed, those guys. So they were dominant. But when you look at the defense, it was Cornelius Bennett and Bruce Smith. And then Daryl Talley was a solid player, but then just a bunch of other guys. So in talking to Bill Polian in the past, he talked about your team is your offensive personnel, and then it's your pass rushers, another defensive playmaker, and then maybe a corner. Maybe. Doesn't always need to be a corner because you can be zone centric and get away with it. But you got to have two pass rushers and you need to have another playmaker somewhere on the second level. DJ, when you're the Kansas City Chiefs and you fall into Patrick Mahomes and you see how Patrick Mahomes plays and you see how that offense is playing, it changes the way you do everything on defense. If I'm Steve Spagnuolo, I'm calling the game like it's an arena football game, meaning all I'm playing for is one or two stops.
That's why they're blitzing as much or more than anybody.
I'm blitzing all the time because all I'm trying to do is to force you into a negative play to get you in third and 15 so I can either get you off the field or I can steal get a
possession.
Turnover.
Yeah.
Right. And so when we talk about complementary football is not just how you play the game on game day, but it's how you build your team. Because if I'm expected to have a high octane offense in the salary cap era, then that means, okay, look, we're going to score points. I paid my quarterback. I give him all these weapons. Our salary cap pie goes heavily towards the offense. Well, defensively, we're only going to invest in pass rushers and a playmaker somewhere in the back end, safety, corner, linebacker, whatever that is. Because the expectation is offense. Every week I expect you to put up 30. Defense, and man, we can just hold them to 24 is great. And also, DJ, when you talk about that, you give up rushing yards if you're a team that's like that because teams that run it take longer to score. Mm-hmm. In the National Football League, it takes you a long time to run the ball down the field and score touchdowns. There's a cumulative effect of the running game that typically doesn't take place until the third and fourth quarter. Well, if you've been running and moving the ball, but you've been selling for threes and with zip coming down the field like Roadrunner,
yeah,
it's 14-3, it's 21-6, and you have to get out of running the football. Mm-hmm. And then I got you because now you're playing my game. And so there is something to that. So when you're a team builder, you have to understand exactly who you are offensively so that you can build your defense to complement. If you're not good on offense, then your defense has to be a dominant defense that gets the ball back, gives you short fields, gives you opportunities.
Yeah, no doubt. It's fun when you can kind of marry up what you see with your eyes on the video and then be able to match it up with some of the statistical data that we've been able to throw out there. So I hope you guys enjoyed that conversation. All right, we're going to get to our interview with Oregon head coach Mario Cristobal right after this. All right, Buck, excited to welcome our friend back to the show here, Mario Cristobal. Coach, I'd be curious, you know, we'll get into where the season goes from here, but I'd love to know what the first practice after the Ohio State game was like up there in Eugene.
Honestly, it was the same as the ones before and the previous week. Obviously, I get it, right? When there's a little extra something and playing on a big stage, it always brings a little bit more intensity, I would say. But in terms of the physicality and the commitment to doing that, playing on a certain level in practice is real and it's strong. And we always refer to it as our secret sauce. You know, we train a certain way. We, you know, talk a certain way so we can play a certain way. And it shows up, especially after a big game, heck, they're all big games. The next one's the biggest game anyway. So,
you know, Coach, from the time that you've taken over the program, you've always kind of talked about the long-term vision of kind of being a heavyweight contender, right? The way that you build the team, you build it not just with an eye towards being able to win and dominate the pack, but being able to dominate opponents outside of it, those who you eventually have to play to win the title. How hard is it to set that vision? And even when your program is not there, but to stay committed to, no, this is where we're going and this is how we have to get there.
Well, it starts with the people, and it starts with the people that you hire. It starts with the people that you recruit. It starts with your treatment and your teaching of people as well. You know, your care factor has got to be real and genuine. You can't fake your way through this, man. I'm like you guys. I sat in those locker rooms. I knew if a coach was real or if he was full of baloney. And if he was full of baloney, you know, it just doesn't – it's not the same. So the buy-in to physicality is something that you got to work, man. I mean, you could talk about it all you want. We have some unbelievable guest speakers, but there's no one's going to talk a guy into continually – throwing his body around with technique and fundamentals in mind and max effort, but with physicality and coming out of their hips and striking and running through contact. That takes time and it takes practice and it takes teaching because no one comes out of that womb, you know, just swinging away and being that guy. You got to work at it. And our guys, I'm grateful to them because I'm a little difficult sometimes to deal with, but they've allowed me to push them. It started with an agreement. We promised them, we promised every single player, you're going to have an unbelievable Power Five experience if you just allow us to push you to this level. You won't have a breakdown. We'll have a breakthrough when we get to that edge. And I think we've had that a couple times. And I think we're just kind of scratching the surface. We think we're going to be real good here in the next several years.
Coach, I remember, you know, going back to the time with the Ravens and seeing Ed and Ray come through there, and there was just a different thing. You know it, the Miami thing's just different. Those guys are wired a little different. There's a different level of passion and commitment with that group. How have you gone about trying to instill some of that Miami? You know, everybody talks about you, and they always talk about Alabama. I'm like, you forget this guy. This is Miami. This is long before Alabama. How much of that have you been able to instill in this group up there in Eugene?
Well, I mean, I remember walking in that locker room as a freshman. It's 1988, dating myself now. It's not good. So I'm a little bit older, but I remember, I guess the word was, I was terrified not to uphold the standard. Mm-hmm. And that's like real. That's about as truthful as I could be. I saw the level of, heck, I used to go over there in high school and try to watch those guys after practice. I remember two guys that stick out, Benny Blades and Michael Irvin, doing one-on-ones after practice. And it looked like a fist fight. It looked like a brawl. And then going over to Alabama and the application of sports psychology, practice regimentation that goes with it, down to the rep, the offseason, the fourth quarter program. I felt like I've been around some really good mentors, some awesome people. Greg Schiano at Rutgers, that place, you know, at the time, probation, 111, you know, and all of a sudden, bam, you know, learning from him and how he turned that program around. So all those things have had a tremendous impact. We brought it here in our own way, but the blueprint and that DNA about, well, I can't say certain, you know what I mean? The DNA of getting after it, it's well and alive in this program. We've recruited the right coaches, the right players that buy into it, even if it's not instantly over time, guys are getting it. And, but we don't try to copy anybody, you know, we're ourselves. There's a heavy influence from those programs here. There's no doubt. You know that. The blueprint,
Bucky,
is what it is.
Bucky, I think what he's trying to say is there's some stuff in their neck, I think is that's what he's going with.
Yeah, they have.
You can say it. I can't.
They certainly have that. And I think this is so unique. Like, obviously, DJ and I are here on the West Coast, so our eye tends to skew towards Pac-12 football. And for the longest time, even we were scouting, they were talking about maybe some of the softness that existed in the Pac compared to, hey, if you play in the SEC or the Big Ten, those things. So as you take Oregon, and we're just talking about Oregon, how do you build your team in that mold that you know you have to be built to be able to play with those other heavyweight contenders?
Well, it starts in the trenches, and we invested heavily in the trenches. I mean, heck, turning on – well, we can't watch TV, but I know on Sunday, I guess we had 6 or 7 offensive linemen playing that had played here just recently. One of them being a top 10 pick this past year at 20 years old. And then you've got, I remember arriving here in 2017, Henry Mondu was already here. He's doing great things with the Steelers. So Justin Hollins, it just starts with the trenches and being able to practice, you know, your one-on-ones, your 2-on-2s, your 5-on-4s, your 7-on-7, progression teaching, progression drilling, and eventually carry it over to team and unit work, and then make it that translate over to game day. So that was the initial part, but that mentality has been carried over to the perimeter as well. You watch guys like Johnny Johnson for us and Jalen Redd, they play just as hard with the ball in their hands or without the ball in their hands. I mean, physicality is a real thing. Physicality is something that you don't brag about or you don't boast about. You just take pride in putting on film because, you know, talking about it and proclaiming it isn't real, brother. You better show it because that tape's not going to lie. And we're getting better at it. We still got a long ways to go, but we're blessed with some really good leaders and we're progressing well.
Coach, I'm curious on measurements. You're recruiting high school kids. Obviously, you come through the combine, you come into the NFL. We know how long these guys are. We get all that information. What type of information are you able to gather on these high school kids? And you've got to project out body type growth too, which is totally different than what we have to deal with.
Well, you know, we do the same thing. Our model is very much an NFL model. I mean, we've had the great fortune of having the ability to visit several NFL organizations, spend time with them. When they visit, I just – they probably are so sick of me because I just keep them there and just extrapolate information from their brains, man, just trying to get better. So they probably won't come back now, but they've really helped us. And then, man, I remember I had a coach back at Miami used to say, you know, recruiting is the most imperfect science because you just don't know which direction that mindset's going to go, that body's going to explode or shrink down to. So you do your best by really digging deep into them as a person, their family, the traits, you know, their size and growth potential, their ability to, you know, let's call it first availability. Once you check their transcript and look down for days late or days absent, right? First rule of being successful is you better show up, not just show up on time. If that thing shows 45 absentees, you know, you're probably not going to change that, you know, but so there's so many things that go into it, but, you know, availability, durability, all those things are, in our opinion, they are tangible abilities that you can measure and observe and see. And they're tied into this whole, because it's hard to be a college football player now. There's a lot going on. Class is demanding, you know, the pressures of, we used to have the sandlot pressures. Now it's social media and everything that comes with it, right? You turn on your Twitter account, you got 40,000 people telling you you're great or you stink. Mm-hmm. You know, how many teenage, you know, young men can handle that? And how you got to coach them and teach them through it. So anyways, you're recruiting strong-minded, strong-willed guys that are willing to work and that love the game.
You know, it's funny, Coach, because you've talked about it, and we've had private conversations where you talked about the important part of the mental part of it, like sports performance, mental performance, and those things. Can you touch on when did you fall in love with that part of it, and when did you see that it was so necessary to help your team go from good to great?
Yeah. Well, I just, over the years, I realized that what worked on me doesn't work for normal people. I was a very average football player, and I love my high school coach. First guy I went and found in Columbus, Ohio, after the game, he was there because he was just so hard on us all the time. I mean, just up and down the field relentlessly. I'm like, does this guy have a problem with me? Because it's like relentless. But I loved it. It just drove me every single day. And when I, you know, after spending time at Miami with guys like, you know, Trevor Moad, may he rest in peace, you know, recently passed, man, last week, great influence. Kevin Elko was absolutely awesome with us at the University of Miami and at Alabama. You know, Brett Ledbetter that works with us here, you know, Phil Beckner who works with us here. I mean, you name it. All these minds, I kept seeing the impact of turning a mindset to go in a direction where it was just harnessing all that energy, that, I don't know what you call it, the inner strength, the DNA, just to go in the right direction more consistently, as opposed to just, all right, competition will take care of it. Maybe this guy's better now. Keep that thing alive. Make everybody better. It'll make the competition and turn your team grow. So I think all those places showed me a lot about how important the psychological part of the game is. And I'm a big believer in it and still learning a lot from it and about it. But we're heavily invested in it.
It's amazing, Coach, when you can train the person as well as the player, the results that you end up getting out of that. We've talked about some offensive line, and you guys have built a great offensive line factory there. I'm curious on the defensive line. We had a chance. We were doing a prototype series last year, and so we were talking about all these different positions. So we had a bunch of D-line coaches on, and we were talking about kind of the non-negotiables, what you got to have. And everybody started with get-off. Like, it seemed like that just came up over and over and over again. Curious to get your thoughts on the importance of get-off, and then you've got a guy there. I know he's been a little nicked up, but in Kayvon, what you see from him in terms of his get-off.
Yeah, it's different now. I mean, that looks like a rocket ship when he comes off the ball. And it's explosive, but it comes with power. He's very heavy-handed. I think that's important. You know, sometimes guys have a get-off, and they do it with poor pad level. To have that type of a get-off with a flat back and heavy-handed, where the hands work inside where you're going and playing low to high, is a big thing. I can't tell you how many times as an offensive line coach you watch a defensive lineman and they're explosive with that get off, but they stand straight up and expose
a lot of surface.
It's like, well, we'll take that, you know. And then the other guys that are so low and make themselves so skinny and have that slither to them, or they can flip their hips with the surface that you're trying to get contact with, shrinks, it's reduced. Those are the guys that are really, really hard to block. Now you throw in power, the guys that have that, you know, man, as a lineman, that wasn't a very quick-footed guy, man. Those guys are like frightening to go against. And then you add power where you could get caught in a crossover and that thing goes speed of power and they run right through you, brother. That's awesome stuff. Those guys are game changers, you know. And credit to our guys. We've been down. We've been down 5-6 starters at one point almost, you know, a little bit more. And guys have stepped up. And Kayvon's done a really good job coaching those guys. But, yeah, those are some of the traits that you look for. Mm-hmm. And guys that are versatile, man. Guys that are versatile that are really, really smart. Because if they are, you can do a lot of different things. And it's like a receiver, right? You don't want to put the receiver in the same spot every single down. But they'll find them. Trail coverage, right? Two-man, mm-hmm. all that stuff. Well, you want to do the same with your really good D-line.
You know, it's funny because we talk about traits. DJ and I talk about building teams. Like, there are two positions we always start with. One is quarterback, and then you just talked about pass rusher. You recently had Justin Herbert there. You got a first-round pick, has been playing outstanding. But now you have another young quarterback or quarterback that you got from Boston College in Brown. When you think about the core traits that you need at the quarterback position, what are some of those things that you feel like are non-negotiables?
And I think all the things that everybody talks about, I do. And all those traits about, you know, the guy's got to be able to anticipate, great pocket presence. You know, he's got to be accurate. He's got to understand protection. So he's got to have a high football IQ. I think the part that not many people talk about, he's got to win over the team. Mm-hmm. You know, his supporting cast has to believe in him and want him to succeed so badly that they're exhausting themselves on a play-by-play basis and refusing to put a single rep on film where the opponent outworks him because they believe in that quarterback and they want him to do well. And, you know, guys that are good players, they gain some of that affinity, but the ones that are tough, right? The ones mm-hmm. that go out of their way to bring the right type of correction and calling teammates up, sometimes calling them out, but calling them and lifting them up and taking the onus of responsibility when things may not go so well and generating the type of belief that there's no bad play, no bad call, no injury that we can't overcome because we're just going to keep coming. Those type of intangibles, man, I know as a lineman, I would kill myself blocking for guys like that. And I had quarterbacks like that. So, but all the other traits, yeah, there's for quarterbacks, there's about 55 non-negotiables. The intangible side is just as non-negotiable. Those things go a long, long way, man. A long, long way. And you see it. These guys really believe in Anthony, and it merits their support and belief because of what he's done.
Coach, this is the last question from me. I was doing the Charger game the other day and was up there in the booth, and there was 70,000 people there. It's the Dallas Cowboys. And I kind of every now and then you have those moments in life where you kind of get overwhelmed with gratefulness, and you kind of think of your 12-year-old self and what we get to do in this world. Have you had those moments throughout your career where you just said, man, you're the head coach at Oregon. You guys just went in the shoe and beat Ohio State. Yeah. You still allow yourself to have those kind of pinch me moments of this is pretty dang sweet.
Oh, man, bless me on measure. I don't even begin. I every morning and night, I, you know, very thankful in prayer and for all the incredible blessings. And I think the best way I could show gratitude is by pouring every ounce of my heart and soul into these players, these programs, this community. Get up and go to sleep at hours that I won't even put out there because you wouldn't believe it. But because of the gratitude, man, I'm just a Cuban kid from Miami, you know, that some people believed in and always gave me a shot. So I worked hard. And now this is here. And now the only thing on my mind is just pouring myself into our players, our coaches who are awesome. This is not a one-man show or an operation. I know I often get to be in front of the microphone and the camera. It ain't about me at all. This is a total joint, galvanized family that just goes. And so I want to make sure I do my part.
Coach, I have to ask you this as a high school head coach. I have to ask you because I believe it's really important to ask those who've walked in shoes. So as a head coach, we have a bunch of coaches that listen to our podcast. What would be one piece of advice that you could give a head coach who is going through a rough period with his team? If his team had lost, if they're trying to battle back or anything like that, what would be something that you would pass on or share to an aspiring coach?
Oh, man, there's a lot of things I would share because we've all gone through it. You know, I mean, heck, I took a job against everybody's advice at FIU at a place that was 0-12. was told the day after I took the job, hey, by the way, you're going to get probation. You're going to lose about 30 scholarships. 17 of your players are ineligible. But here's the good news. You play Florida, Alabama, Miami. Oh, and by the way, you don't have a locker room, officer, or practice field. So I should have had my head examined. And I remember, you know, a very tremendous mentor of mine. He said, look, if you take this job, the day you get it, you're going to feel like, you know, like you've won some major award, man. Everybody's going to love you. You're the man. And then when the season starts, because of the rebuilding job you have to do, you're going to suddenly become the worst coach to ever live. You're going to fall off the face of the earth into a black hole where, man, you are just looking up and just hoping and praying that it goes by. It's like you need these painful steps, because there are certain painful steps in the building of a program that you cannot and you should never, ever skip. Never. They are integral. They are critical to the development of you as a coach. They are critical in the development of the program and understanding what you cannot do or shouldn't happen with preparation, or what you have to get better at, so that when the moments and the opportunities, when you're equipped to really win them, that you never allow to learn yourself that lesson twice, you know. And as sure as the sun's gonna, you know, set on that side, what side am I on? Yeah, it'll set on that side. It's on that side. Those days, they will pass. If you have the right values and principles, stick to them. Don't be swayed. Everyone's going to have a better answer. Everyone's going to have. I can't tell how many coaches, man, at midfield, I'm there with a team, man. I'm, you know, 50 scholarship bodies, guys. Some guys hadn't even started in high school, but they stuck with it, man. Tough dudes. And I remember Urban Meyer, Mangino, all those guys at midfield. Hey, I know it's rough now. Stay the course, man. There's signs there. Stay the course. And I'd be like, is he really watching the tape? Because we don't look very good, you know? Yeah, man, stay the course, man.
That's awesome. That is awesome. Hey, Coach, this has been awesome, man. You every time we visit with you, I'm always struck by the fact you know who you are, you know what you're about, and it comes across. And we are rooting for you guys. Hope you guys finish up strong here and stay healthy, man.
Appreciate you guys. God bless and go Ducks.
Buck, it's a pleasure to talk to Coach Cristobal. Again, I keep coming back to the same thing every time we talk to him. There's some guys you talk to and you're like, that dude knows who he is, knows what he's about. And I think sometimes you can get labeled as he's a tough guy, right? And it's all the toughness. But when I listen to that, to me, when you listen to him talk, it's the hustle that goes along with that toughness. It's the work ethic that marries with that toughness. That's the secret sauce.
Look, I think it is the secret sauce. And here's what I love about Coach Cristobal. And I feel like he opens up each and every time we talk to him. I love how transparent he is about what he's learned along the way and how he's implemented those things with his team at his program at Oregon, while also allowing Oregon to have their own identity. A few years ago when we talked, he talked about, we got to build a team to beat SEC teams. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that they did is they started playing SEC teams so they would know exactly where they were. When you look at this team plays an SEC style of football that works. They run the football. They're physical, fast, and aggressive on defense. He has talked about the toughness part of it. And for years, the West Coast and the Pac-12 had a stigma about being very soft in the terms of the way they played and those things. And that softness sometimes would show up, even though when USC was good, USC would go into the SEC and beat
Hammer
all
those guys. Yeah.
So. True. It's a combination, but I just love what he has done, and I love the identity. And because of what he said, I can imagine him now building this program up to leave it to go somewhere else, because there's conversations not only about SC, but also if Miami, the University of Miami, makes a move because he played there.
You can't take that job.
He's not going back there.
No,
back there. Like he's done all the heavy lifting and the hard work. Why start all over?
Yeah, there's that flywheel principle, right? Where it takes forever to pull on that wheel and pull on that wheel. And then once it starts spinning, it just keeps going. Well, he's got the thing spinning. Why would you want to go start pulling on the thing again? it doesn't make any sense. So, no, I'm with you. I think he ends up staying there at Oregon. But it was great to catch up with him. I always appreciate him giving us some of his time. But it's been a fun podcast. We're going to wrap it up, Buck, right after this. Well, Buck, I'm excited, man. I'm again be heading out to Kansas City. Chargers Chiefs should be a fun matchup. The great rivalry between the two teams. The Chiefs have owned this division for a long time. They look up right now, though. They're looking up at the Raiders and the Broncos. So both these teams, it feels like a pretty important game for them. So I'm looking forward to that. On the way out there, going to watch a little college football on the plane. Any games you're particularly looking forward to this weekend?
Oh, Notre Dame, Wisconsin. I can't wait to see that game. I mean, you have a quarterback who left Wisconsin to go to Notre Dame. So it's going to be personal. I expect him to play at his best. And then also, the one thing that Notre Dame does, it's a little bit of the truth serum when it comes to looking at defensive personnel, because you know what Wisconsin's going to do. They're going to line up here and they're going to run it at you. And so we're going to find out real quick if you're tough enough to be able to kind of withstand and play in the running game, even though we just spent 30 or 40 minutes talking about the run game and why it doesn't really matter if you gain yards in the National Football League.
In college, you can beat some teams up, though. In college, you can beat some teams up with that run game. I'm looking forward to a great college football weekend. NFL-wise, again, it's a good slate. Looking forward to it. Every NFL weekend is great. So I saw somebody putting some pressure on the Indianapolis Colts with their expectations potentially staring down an 0-3. We get 17-game season, man. We got a long way to go. So anything else you want to add before we jump out of here?
No, it's a marathon, not a sprint. And people have to remember, 17 games is a long time. DJ, the only thing that you're shooting for the first half of the year, and we talked about how some teams would treat the month of September like the preseason. You just want to be in the race.
Yeah.
You don't want to be out of the race. So if you can get to the 9-game mark, anywhere around 500 or better, you're good. Because the last half of the season is when you really want to turn it on and play your best.
All right. Well, on Monday, I officially indoctrinate you into the Seattle Kraken club here. It's a sweet lid, right?
Sweet lid. Nice logo.
Ricky O hooking us up. All right. That's going to do it for us. Hope you guys have had fun with us today. Again, thanks to Oregon head coach Mario Cristobal. Thanks to David Singer, our booker, for getting that done. Singer is the best in the business, even if he's a Dodger fan. All right. We'll catch you next time right here on Move the Sticks.